Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness, and now Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it's the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology and about how you can make the most of your own life.
And this is Dr. Peter Bregan. I'm delighted to be with you. Interesting things going on in Great Britain. So those of you who are listening from Great Britain, just hang in there with me here for a second now. The BBC asked me about a day or so ago to come on the air following a physician who had been injured by ECT to talk about it. And between myself and the physician, we produced a 10-minute BBC report that is absolutely stunning. I will have it up on my website in the next, hopefully today. And I've sent out access to it to the Critical Psychiatry Network in Great Britain. And I'm just hoping that this can be a turnaround. The BBC did a really honorable, brave, and courageous act in putting this on the air. So especially you folks in Great Britain, for goodness sakes, get on this and let's get the word out in Great Britain about how damaging this is. Now, my guests today, well, they're dear friends. They're great psychologists and psychotherapists. They are activists. They are brave. They are courageous. They are married. And their names are Tim Evans and Jerry Carter. Tim and Jerry, are you there?
We're here.
We are here.
Oh, I'm really glad you're there. Now, we are having a conference together. Tim and Jerry are leaders in the Adlerian Society of Florida. I have spoken or even co-sponsored their annual conferences for many years now. They put on really wonderful conferences. And this year they invited me to co-sponsor again and to organize a day and to suggest speakers. And this is genuinely a conference to go to if you're interested in my work, if you're interested in critical psychiatry, and if you're interested in some of the most positive, socially oriented, caring approaches in psychology, which fall under the rubric of Adlerian psychology and the great psychologist Alfred Adler, whose writings had a profound influence on me in my youth and have stayed with me to today. The conference starts on March 3rd. It's in a lovely seaside spa on Tampa Bay. Guys, what's the name of the spa again? I've only been there five times.
It's called the Safety Harbor Resort and Spa.
Thank you.
And you're welcome. It's only 20 minutes from the Tampa International Airport.
It's really a beautiful place. It's right on Tampa Bay. It has a big pier you can walk out on and a beautiful town. I mean, Ginger, my wife, who made it there a few years ago, said, "Why, honey, if I had to live in Florida, I'd little town of Safety Harbor." The first day is going to be a variety of positive psychological approaches organized by Tim and Jerry. The second day, now it's March 2nd, the first day is March 3rd. March 3rd is the first day. March 4th, I'm going to be organizing the day. And I'm going to provide something unique, which is just three top speakers on the cutting edges of psychiatry, both critical and positive. Peter Gerche, who is a Danish physician researcher of the highest standards, who started researching the psychiatric literature, couldn't believe how bad it is. He's now written two books, including Deadly Medicine, comparing the pharmaceutical industry to the mafia, which, of course, makes psychiatrists mostly abating and abetting criminal activities from his viewpoint. Robert Whitaker, who most people listening to this broadcast know well from his a number of his really really good books, looking into psychiatry and discussing positive alternatives, and then myself. So we're going to do like a whole day there and then a panel. Then on Saturday, March 5th, Peter is going to be the plenary speaker. And then there are going to be workshops. I'm going to do a workshop. Tim, Jerry, do you know, is Whitaker going to do a workshop? Is Peter also going to do a workshop?
Peter is going to be our keynote in the morning, and he's going to talk about the harm caused by the forced treatment and the Baker Act, which I think all psychotherapists should hear. Tim and I personally have never Baker Acted anyone.
And I'm going to do a workshop after Peter's talk, and my workshop is just going to be an opportunity to sit and talk with me. I mean, I get phone calls from all over the world. I mean, all over the world every day, some of them in foreign languages. And I just can't talk to all the people who want to talk to me. But if you come to this conference, we can talk in this small workshop that I'll be conducting after Peter's talk. And then there are going to be other really interesting and good workshops as well. It's going to be a fabulous conference. You can go to my website and look at the very top where I talk about, you know, my important new events. And you can click on to a brochure, my website, of course, Breggin.com, Breggin. So anybody that doesn't know how to spell it who's listening, Breggin.com. And you can also click over to Tim and Jerry's website for the conference. And you can also go directly to the conference website, and I think they can just Google the 2016 Adlerian Conference in Florida and get there. Anything more direct that you want to suggest about getting information?
Yes, very simply, Peter. It's www.adlerflorida.org, and that will get you straight to the conference brochure and the Florida Adlerian Society. And, of course, you can always check Tim and I out at www.carterandevans.com.
All right, folks. That's the advertising. That's the promotion. It will be the only conference that I know of that Peter and Ginger Breggin – Ginger won't be at the conference, but that Peter and Ginger Breggin and the Center for the Study of Empathic Therapy will be co-sponsoring this year. And thanks to Tim and to Jerry, we have as much input and as many good speakers nearly as we would if we were just doing it ourselves from our viewpoint. And then you get the added attraction of a really positive psychological, social approach from the Adlerians and from Tim and Jerry. Are you two going to do one of your workshops on love and sex and things like that?
Yes, we are, Peter. We're actually going to do a workshop on Thursday, March 3rd, called Mating in Captivity, and we are basing it
I don't
on
believe did you say mating in captivity?
Yeah. That is exactly what I said.
That's fabulous.
It is going to be fabulous. It is. And the reason is that it's all going to be about maintaining erotic intelligence. And that is a term coined by Esther Perel, who's a sex therapist in New York City. But she has got some fabulous information about how to maintain desirability in a couple's relationship over the long haul. And it's very interesting because we do some things as Americans that actually work against our sex lives that you wouldn't think do work against your sex lives, such as when two people are all enmeshed in each other and too close, that there's no room for the erotic spark. So there needs to be a little bit of mystery in the relationship. And that'll be just part of what we talk about that day. But she has some very, very interesting ideas that Tim and I have really kind of gotten excited about.
And on the relationship part, Peter, and I think we see you and Ginger being able to do this. When we talk to people about what their goal of their marriage is, lots of times you can ask people what the goal of marriage is, and they really can't give you an answer. But, you know, when we first start out, when we meet somebody and we start dating them, we're with them because it's playful and it's fun. And we like to sort of keep that as a theme. I mean, if somebody were asked, Jerry or I, what the goal of our marriage is, we'd probably say that the top goal is keeping it playful and fun and making the relationship more of a priority. I think what happens in marriage lots of times is people, because they're married, they expect to decrease the prioritizing of the marriage and think that they have plenty of time to make up for it later in life. And I think that's a mistake. I think we should increase the priority of the marriage and make the marriage a priority. So we're going to probably be discussing a lot of those attitudes and trying to keep it playful and fun because we just all work too much.
You know, this is really interesting. And let's just talk a little bit about this and then see where we want to go on topics. One of the things I'm seeing all the time in my practice is that people who were romantically in love end up so preoccupied with work, and then they get slammed often with raising children, which really can slam people in our modern life where we don't have extended families usually to support the raising of children. And people just have a terrible time, no matter how much they love each other. Often they have a terrible time keeping love alive and passion alive and interest alive when they're dealing right at the peak of the stresses of work and right at the peak of raising kids. Is that your experience too?
Well, yes. And I think we, with our Puritan values, I guess you're going to talk about Britain. If people are in England, I'm not blaming them. But with our Puritan values, that the Puritans settled America, and the idea was that, if you seek pleasure, that's not godlike. And it was almost like the more work and the more suffering you are, the more closer you are to God. And our culture still has that whole Puritan work ethic, and I think we overdo it. I noticed this summer I was listening to NPR, and they were talking about the amount of days Americans will take off for summer vacation this past summer was like 3. Where over in Europe, they're taking 6 weeks off. But we see, and I just had a case today where they over-prioritize work. We always ask a couple, and it's a good measuring, when they come in for an assessment, when was the last time the two of you had fun alone? And you really have to stick to that statement, fun alone, because they'll tell you, but then you go alone, and they'll go, no, our kids, our family, our extended friends were there, and then you got to add the word fun. And we find that that's really a mental health issue. You really have to learn how to prioritize your marriage. Not that Jerry and I do it perfectly, but in our calendar, we meet once a week. We have a couples meeting once a week. It's a business meeting, and we plan our fun time. I think we have something scheduled from now through November, and that is sacred because that is our foundation. As long as we're having fun and taking the time and making our relationship a priority, which I think is the foundation of our 4 kids, our office, our job, I think as long as we're doing that, we can be solid. But it's so easy, like you said, to lose ourselves in the work ethic and validating ourselves externally from our accomplishments and how much money we make. And I tell everybody that the secret, I think, to having a happy marriage is you treat it as if it's not permanent. And the mistake people make is they treat their marriage as if it's permanent. If you treat it as if it's permanent, you put it on hold, you stop watching what you're saying to your partner, and you get into the whole notion of obligation. And obligation leads to resentment, and resentment is sulfuric acid on love. But if you treat your partner like it's temporary, like they could leave you at any moment, you really start having to watch what you say to them. You have to make sure you don't use any criticizing, blaming, complaining. And you really have to take the time out to have a together experience and encouraging each other.
Well, it's so consistent with what I believe about treasuring each other, treasuring the people we love as if they, you know, have just arrived and are bedazzling and mean the world to us, and that we have to guard them and protect them and make sure that we stay together and that we can share this for the rest of our lives. And I really do believe that, well, I know from my own experience, of course, with Ginger, and you know from each other, that we can just continue to thank God for each other for the rest of our lives if we make it the central priority. That no matter what else we're doing, we're going to have that. And, of course, the two of you and the two of us are extraordinarily busy people, but we keep coming back to what matters the most for our happiness, our sanity, our health, is loving each other and treasuring each other. Folks, so you really can live like that.
Yes, I think that's the secret to happiness. I think you're spot on, Peter. We tell people if you want a simple way to go about doing this, all your choices, everything you say and do, does it move you closer or further apart from your partner? I mean, it's a great way to make decisions. If we make this decision, does that help our marriage? Does it move us closer in our marriage, or does it move us further apart? And that's also true with what you say to your partner or even your behavior. You can just do it. It's sort of an interesting experiment for just a day. Just everything you say or do, does it connect or disconnect? Does it move you closer or does it move you further apart? And you would know this better than me, but I think it's in our DNA code. I think it's in our genetics that we get messages about not disconnecting. I think we get very strong messages, like if I say this is a disconnection. Because you'll hear actually people say it, like, I know I shouldn't say this, and I'm like thinking, okay, well then don't. But your body, your brain's telling you not to disconnect. And I think we have human beings have a strong innate feature where we move towards connection and not disconnection. And I think we lose it in the culture, we lose it in our ability to make choices, or we lose it in trying to validate ourselves through work and money and not moving towards our partners where we can get our needs for love and belonging, freedom and fun met.
Absolutely. You know, that we human beings, we evolved over 2 million years from these little bipeds who climbed out of trees 2 or 3 million years ago, and we didn't have fangs, and from the beginning we didn't have hooves and claws. We didn't have the strength to break an antelope's neck. We couldn't even run as fast as most predators or the game we would – any predators or the pretty much or the game we were chasing. So it's been really key for us to work together. That has always been who we are. We survive by working together and being together. And then the nurturing of our children is such a complicated task. It requires so much attention that, again, we have raised these helpless little infants more helpless than any other infants born, except those that go into pouches like kangaroo pouches. Just the most helpless little fetal creatures when we give birth to them. And it requires just so much connectivity. And it's so interesting to hear you talking so much the way I talk with my patients or clients. I just will tell folks, now listen, I want you to make sure that every word you say today in couples therapy, every word is meant to move the relationship along, to enhance the relationship. And it becomes a little comical when I raise my hand as I see an expression that is introducing a word that is going to be anything but enhancing. And I say, wait, is this going to improve your relationship? Is that what's on your mind right now? How do I make this thing, how do I make it better? How do I make it more loving? How do I get over the humps? And to many people, this is going to sound idealistic. Well, it is, but it's going to sound too idealistic, unrealistic, impractical. But folks, we are all such conflicted human creatures. We all have so much garbage in our heads that the only way we can have these wonderful, loving relationships with our children, with our friends, with our lovers, with our wives, husbands, is by putting all our effort into this kind of kind, loving, caring, thoughtful communication. Tim and Jerry, again, let me tell you who we're talking with. You know, we're talking to really dear friends of mine, Tim and Jerry. Tim Evans, Jerry Carter, psychologists in Tampa, Florida. You can find them easily on the web. And you can come hear us speak. We're all going to be heavily involved with a lot of wonderful people in just a little bit outside of Tampa, just 20 minutes or less from the airport, this coming March 3rd, not very far away, 3rd, 4th, and 5th, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. Tim and Jerry, it looks like we're talking about relationship and love. Let me ask you a question. Where in the balance of things with the enjoyment of physical sexual relationship, where in that balance do you think love and relationship and caring is on the one hand, and on the other, learning to let go of sexual inhibitions or learning new sexual techniques? In other words, what's the balance between, quote, good sex and good love in your minds?
I'm gonna let Jerry answer this, but Peter, you wrote a book on guilt, anxiety, and shame. And that book, I mean, those three emotions that you wrote that book about, that's part of the answer. I'm going to let Jerry answer. But that's part of the equation, having an interesting erotic life. But if you can't, you got to handle that guilt, anxiety, and shame. And I think your book addresses keeping those emotions in check to sort of become a free human being, to free yourself in terms of just being human.
It is amazing how much guilt, shame, and anxiety is evoked at the mere thought of sex, and how much it inhibits and distorts sexual loving relationships, and also anger and numbing, which I view as derivatives, anger and numbing, derivatives of guilt, shame, and anxiety. They're just ways of trying to escape guilt, shame, and anxiety. We get angry or we get numb, and how much these interfere with a loving relationship and with everything creative in our lives. Thank you for mentioning the book Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety. The basic idea of the book is learn to identify these biologically built-in and I think useless in modern life emotions, learn to identify them, reject them, and live by reason, ethics, and love. Reason, ethics, and love. And that's nowhere more obvious than in our sexual relationships, which often challenge our ability to be reasonable, loving, and ethical. So you're with me on that. It's really what we bring to the table or the bed or the couch in terms of love and emotional freedom that really matters in our sexual lives too.
It does matter, Peter. So love and caring and responsibility taking for your partner is on one plane. And, you know, that is done throughout the day. That's done from the minute you wake up in the morning till the minute you go to bed at night. You know, just being there for another, being supportive of another, loving another. You know, that is all so important in sexuality. But desire and sexuality is a whole nother plane where you do need that freedom from guilt, shame, and anxiety. You really do, because that's your sexual expression, which is different than a loving expression, meaning desire. But it's all needed. It kind of all works in tandem to have a nice, loving sexual relationship. I think that in order to have desire or to have passion, let's say, you have to be able to express yourself freely with your partner. And that's where guilt, shame, and anxiety can just ruin a sex life. And, you know, we see clients, I know you do too, where, you know, things have happened, you know, such as rape or incest, something like that, where, you know, it just totally messes up the sexual desire because of the shame attached to it. So, you know, we see a lot of things like that, but it's a very intricate process, I think. And we as people are both passionate as well as loving.
And then you get these dichotomies mm-hmm. going and confusion going about what is love. Like when they did research about desirability, and this is semantics, but and they found it unique to the United States, the two things that kill desirability is being overly responsible, which means you become too responsible for your partner's well-being. And when you become too responsible for somebody, that tends to push you into external control. And then the other thing they found that killed desirability was too much caretaking. And we see some people that's their notion of love, that if you love me, you're here to take care of me and make me feel happy. And those people then tend to have a sexless marriage. I think the statistics in the United States, I don't know what they are worldwide, but it's something, Jerry, I think it's like 30% of all married couples have a sexless marriage. I think it might even be higher than that. Which, if you have a sexless marriage, you probably aren't dealing with your guilt, anxiety, and shame. It's a great way to avoid those emotions.
Right, and actually what you end up being aware of usually is just anger and numbness, a combination of being irritated, maybe subtly or maybe outright rageful towards your partner, and at the same time saying to yourself, I don't care, I'm indifferent. It's interesting to see a couple when they first come in, and they can be very angry at each other, and then they're also saying, but I don't care, I don't care. It's like these desperate efforts to try to manage the frustration, the sadness, you know, and the conflict that they are having. I'm very glad to be talking about this, by the way, folks. We didn't plan anything for today. We didn't even have an advanced phone call. I know Tim and Jerry so well. Our basic idea was to hold to have a radio show just before the conference to let everybody know about it. But I think just to tell the audience and to suggest to my guests that let's talk this session as we are about these issues and make a nice podcast about sex and love. One of the keys to me when I help people in this arena is to ask them if they ever were in love. My experience is that most people who go to the trouble, aggravation, and cost of seeking therapy, sometimes many times before they get to me, because I'm generally a therapist, psychiatrist of last resort, for people who have just been having terrible times, that by the time they get to me, they nonetheless remember being in love. They may have forgotten, but they can remember. And I'll ask them, do you remember thinking that he or she was like a gift from God, or how could they be so wonderful, or what would they want from me? I'm not worth it. Do you remember having feelings that the man you met was like a prince, or the woman was like a princess? Do you remember just wanting to be so close and to make love because you felt loving? And most people who seek help have a recollection of that kind of feeling. And I'll say, well, that's what I want to help you get back to, because if you were once in love, I believe that's always there to be found. We just have to get past all of the stuff that's now gotten in the way. Is that your experience, Jerry, Tim?
Yes, it is, Peter. In fact, even John Gottman, in his research, he says that if a couple cannot remember what they loved about each other when they first met, that there's a very good chance that therapy will not help them at all. So it's a great question that you ask your couples. Another question that we ask is, tell us what you like about each other. And we ask them to do that by giving us a paragraph or just by going back and forth until they just expend themselves. But often couples will tear up and cry when they start being tender again. You know, if you start talking about the positives and what you love and admire and, you know, just really seeing the other, I think that is so helpful. And, you know, that's the tool encouragement, which is the exact opposite of criticism. And, of course, criticism is a killer of a relationship.
Boy, it sure is. And yet people and folks, you may be mired down in this yourself if you think about it. People really, when they're frustrated and their backs are up against the wall in a personal relationship, they get the idea that they might be able to criticize their way out of it. And you just see people in the therapy setting wanting to come back to that and come back to that. My gosh, it's totally understandable as one human being to another. But Jerry is right in what she's saying. I mean, it is poisonous to a relationship to try to criticize your way into a better relationship. It won't work. Imagine somebody doing it to you, criticizing you into liking them better, feeling safer with them, loving them more. It can't happen. It can't happen with your children. It can't happen with your parents. It can't happen with your peers and your loved ones. It's extremely important. And if you've been in counseling before or family therapy before and it hasn't worked, ask yourself if the counselor or the therapist addressed love to begin with. Because I see people who have had several counselings over the years and no one just flat out said, well, you know, where's love? Because my goal is to help you all love each other. Oh, no, the goal is communication. They've been working on honest communication, which often means anger and criticism. And I say, nah, now you've been through that. You've probably been doing it. I bet you did it this morning, your honest communication. Let's work on loving communication. Let's build it. Let's build loving communication. That's what we're here to do. Does that make sense to you two?
Oh, you are so on target. You almost sound like us talking to our clients, and we really have the mistaken notion, if you could be this objective, that honest communication, they think that's intimacy, and that's really not intimacy. That's disconnection. But I think we're combating some things I grew up with, like assertiveness training. United States is very unique with people believing that if you assert yourself, you're going to get your needs met and you're going to be better connected. And if you really think about it, when somebody's asserting themselves, they're just asserting their just disjunctive emotions. They're telling somebody what they don't like about the other person. So we've got some values about what communication is in terms of thinking that if you're honest and you assert yourself, which is really just unbridled emotional expression, that somehow that's going to be closeness and intimacy. And that has never worked. I also think we have and I'm not opposed to this, Jerry and I are all for equality, but I grew up in a time where you would hear that a woman needs a man like a fish needs a bicycle. And it overstated and it overemphasized being independent. I had a client one time tell me that, Tim, independence means you're emotionally unavailable. So I think we have a lot of outside values and cultural things that really work against us connecting to each other. We're kind of surprised sometimes when we ask couples, like, when was the last time you told your partner you needed them? And they find that distasteful. They think they're giving up their independence to convey to somebody they need them. But our most common need as human beings is love and belonging. And Peter, I remember you at the conference with the baby crying in the audience, and you brilliantly went over and picked up that child and looked directly in that kid's face and connected with that kid, and that child stopped crying immediately. But of course what's being conveyed is love and belonging and connection.
I actually held the child, just so people have the picture. Yeah. I didn't just look in the child's eyes. I then held the child, and I went and I stood up in front of the group. The picture is on my Facebook page, which is really Ginger. I don't have anything to do with my Facebook page, nor much anyway. She asks me things about what to put on sometimes, but it's hers. But she has a picture of me holding the baby in front of us, this crammed room, which will be the same room, folks. You'll be in with me and Tim and Jerry if you come to the Adlariat conference. It's about connection, yeah.
And if we could prioritize the relationship like you're talking about, being honest or right is not, you know, I looked at Jerry's a theologian, but if you look in the Old and New Testament, everything that's in there is about watch your tongue. Your tongue is your rudder. Watch what you say to the people you love. There's nothing in there about asserting and being honest and direct and telling somebody you love something negative. And that's not how you get your needs met. We're up against that every day.
Yeah, and even asserting not just negativity, I'm sure you agree, asserting your own needs isn't necessarily
right.
How you're going to get them taken care of, because it scares people. It makes them think, well, I got to respond to you. Anytime a person feels coerced, folks, you won't get love. You may get submission. You may get I'm sorry. You may get some other kind of slavish behavior when you demand something, but you can't demand love. There are very rich and powerful people in this world who do not have love, and they know it. And they're often unhappy because having a loving relationship, much more than power over people, is the source of our happiness. And love is it's an invitation we give to people. You know, we say I love you, and we hope they love us back. And we try to be the most loving we can be. The more we give, the more likely we are to get back. The less we demand, and the more we're just present and being loving, the more likely we are to have love. Beware if you feel like you have to push somebody to love you. And beware if you are pushing or being pushed for love. It really is about a relationship free of being made to feel guilty, anxious, or ashamed. It's a relationship free of being coerced or bullied. It's a spontaneous feeling, love, and it has to be nurtured and kind of taken care of, like maybe our ancestors had to nurture and take care of fires and keep them burning and be around them and support the fires. I've not thought of that image before, but it's kind of like that. I have a definition of love that I've used forever in my talks and my books that captures what I mean. And the definition of love for me, and of course, you know, I'm not the greatest philosopher in the world, and I don't have it all down, but this definition helps me, and that is that love is joyful awareness, and that joyful awareness leads to reverence and treasuring of whatever we love. It can be joyful awareness of nature, of God, of a tree in your backyard. For many children, there's a tree that is their most loved object, or their dog in their childhood, or their cat. So that love is a joyful awareness. And if you look with joyful awareness at another human being, it's really going to make them happy. It might make them scared because the guilt or anxiety comes up. But if you can give a joyful aware, be joyfully aware of people around you and of life, it will change your life, and it'll bring people to you who share that desire to be joyfully aware of others. This has been a great key to my own happiness. Jerry,
well,
Tim?
Well, Peter, I think you were spot on when you said you can't coerce people into changing or loving you or behaving. And you can always listen, and sometimes the clients who get it, they laugh at this, because all you have to do is listen to somebody's startup. And when you hear things like, we need to talk, the minute you hear we need to talk, you're thinking, there goes our evening. Or you hear somebody say, I want to be honest with you. The minute you hear somebody say, I'm going to be honest with you, you know there's going to be incoming. It's not going to be what a wonderful, great person you are. These sound like simple ideas, but boy, are they hard to get across to people. Or when we call it crunch time, when people are really on the brink of maybe ending their relationship, it's very hard for them to convince them to quit talking about the relationship. If they go out in the evening or they go home or at night, they start talking about the relationship, and what they're usually talking about is who's right, who's wrong. Somehow we to convince people that the last thing you do in a fight is talk, that's a very hard concept. These sound like simple ideas, and they go, well, what's the alternative? Well, instead of talking about the relationship, why don't you just, and it's what you're talking about, you use the word joy, why don't you go out and just enjoy each other's company? And that would do you so much more good than sharing your honest feelings or talking about the relationship. But that's a tough one to get across to people.
That's really true.
Go ahead, Jerry. Yeah.
But it is tough to get across to people because the next thing that they ask is, well, then how do we solve our problems? You know, we can't talk. And so part of good therapy, Peter, I think you would agree with this, is that we also give people tools on how to communicate in a loving way without ever using any criticism, you know, just how to problem solve. We have little buttons in our office that say, do you want to fight about it or do you want to solve the problem? And solving the problem really just comes down to negotiating an agreement that both people can live with.
But that doesn't mean that we're conflict-free. Many couples have unresolved conflicts their entire lives, and it's just being respectful. Like, I cannot understand Jerry's political viewpoint. It's beyond my comprehension. How can she vote like she does? But we keep it respectful. And those differences and our not agreeing on things also makes each other interesting and intriguing to be with each other.
Right. And it's very, very loving to look at your partner and say, listen, we don't see eye to eye, but I love you the way you are. I would not change a hair on your head. You don't have to agree on everything.
And I think we got a bit, just a little bit. Like, you know you're in a good relationship, and I think you love somebody when you've been with them and you've seen all the imperfections and all the fallibility, and your attitude is, I only want more of the same. I think conveying that ideal to somebody, particularly when things have gone awry or somebody's made a mistake or they've done something that's hurtful to you, the ability, and I think this fits in well with your definition, Peter, is I just want more of the same. When we get going, like, I want you to be different. And, you know, there's three types of movement. There's towards, there's away, and then there's also against. When people get in their head that their partner's against them, that's when all the trouble starts. And lots of times that's a misperception. But once both people start thinking the other person's against me, you know, you're going to have the conflict and the fight. And that's where the encouragement comes in and teaching people conflict resolution.
Yeah, very much, very, very much in agreement. One of the things I suggest to people if they, and this is very hard to do outside of therapy, if they really are just really stuck about an issue, that one person learn the other's viewpoint without saying another right. word, that it becomes one person and one problem, so that the husband may get a chance to just sit and talk about how he needs more physical contact, for example, without asking for more or demanding more, but that he just get a chance to express his feelings without the other person jumping in with shame, I've done my best, or guilt, what do you want from, you know, whatever. One person talking about one problem at a time. And that when that person feels they've gotten across and when they feel the other person understands them, then the other person can then share their viewpoint from it. In the beginning, though, that usually requires a counselor, ombudsman kind of person to help. So I certainly, and I'm sure you do too, believe that we can explore our feelings with each other. But it has to be done in a loving way, and it has to be done in a way that one person is being listened to at a time. It just gets too complicated if you let yourself jump in with your feelings when the other person is talking about something difficult. So one person, one problem, I think, can be can be really, really a helpful approach. One other thought that I have that I find helpful for myself and perhaps for other people is that Ginger and I try to have an hour, usually around 10 o'clock, if we go to bed late, usually we're late and late risers. Thank God I can organize my life the way I want around that, and she can too. That there's a period of time when there's simply nothing difficult is talked about. An hour, 2, 3 hours before bed. That nothing difficult is talked about before bed. We relax, we enjoy each other's company, we spend time together. There was a time for about a year and a half or so where Gingy and I played gin before bed. And that just occupied our hands and kept us just talking about things in a light and fun way. One of us may rub the shoulders of the other for a long time, and during which only sweet things are said, or rub each other's feet, during which time only sweet things are said. And if the other wants to interject and say, oh, God, I was just thinking about the legal case I have in 2 days, I'm on the witness stand or whatever, the other just goes, shush, 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 love, this is not the time. Let's talk about how nice it is to relax. And we literally help each other relax before bed. There's many, you got to find your own ways, but there are many ways that people can do this. Taking a shower together, one person sits in a tub, maybe having a drink together, although beware of drinking in the evening. And it isn't necessarily going to bring out the best in you. Your thoughts about things people can do that are practical? Well,
Peter, I think, we like the idea that, like, after 7 o'clock it's pillow talk. The other thing is, you know, we're trying to keep the erotic life alive and keep the creativity alive. And it's very easy for people to slip in bad habits. And I had a couple in here, and we've gone through the process of helping them get married, and they've been married for a year. And then they were slipping into what people do, like when they go out at night. I go, what do you guys talk about at night? Well, most people, when they go out at night, they've been married, they tend to talk about work, and they tend to talk about kids. And this couple went through their list of what they talked about, and it wasn't very interesting. And I asked them, because we made the list, I asked them, and I said, okay, let's just pretend like you guys get divorced, and you're out on your first date, and you're out with each other on your first date, and let's go through the topics that you two talk about in the evening. And they started laughing, because they said, yeah, if we talked about this to somebody on our first date, we wouldn't last 5 minutes. And with a little bit of discipline, you know, we can keep ourselves interesting. With a little bit of discipline, we don't need to keep talking about work. And I think to keep the marriage alive, you gotta keep yourself interesting. You gotta read books. You gotta learn jokes. I mean, we've been out with couples before, and like the guy has one joke, and every time somebody new comes along, he tells that one joke, and that's his material for the last 8 years. There's no new material, and people become very predictable. And I think it's our task to keep ourselves interesting. When we go out at night, I don't want to talk about work. I really don't even want to talk about the kids, because we spend enough time like that, which means we've got to have some creativity going. One time, a couple years ago, Jerry came in, and she had long blonde hair, and she cut it all off, and she had short, dark hair, and she said, this is a lot cheaper than getting a divorce, and she looked like a totally different person. So, and, you know, as a couple, you know, how are you going to make life interesting as a couple? We can make life interesting pretty good independently, because we've all been trained to do that. But making life interesting as a couple, that's a challenge. And you were talking earlier about the necessity of cooperation. And I think one thing that I like about Adlerian psychology, Adler stressed, and he always talked about the necessity for cooperation. He'd say what cooperation doesn't solve, more cooperation will. And the Germans, they have this idea that when a couple gets engaged, they take them out into the forest and they have them cut down a tree stump with a two-handed saw. And if anybody's worked on a two-handed saw, you realize how much cooperation it takes to make that saw work. You can't have one person being domineering, one person passive. You got to work as equals. And I think this task that you're talking about of working together as a couple to do interesting things and to find interesting things to do together. Last year, Jerry and I took up bicycle riding. We started last Memorial
Tim,
Day.
We've got about a minute or two left.
Okay.
Tie that together. I know you've made bicycling a very important experience for each other. And then I have a closing thought I want to share. Actually, we're down to the last minute.
Let me share a thought. Yeah, yeah.
You know, human beings, we have this extremely tender, sensitive skin. No other creature has it. We can touch each other. If the other person is quietly feeling the touch, they'll know if it's angry. They'll know if it's tender. They'll know if it's sexual and you're trying to arouse them. And they'll know if it's loving. And the key to sex is to take all we're talking about, love, and express it in your touches. Good sex is about loving touches. There may be all kinds of other sex with drugs or whatever that people yell about, say, wow, aggressive sex. I think if you think about your hands as communicating sweet, tender lovingness to your partner, maybe even more than sexual arousal or some mix of it, then you're going to be bringing to sex the love you feel, and that's the key. 20 seconds left, folks. Tim and Jerry, Tim Evans, Jerry Carter. Jerry is J-G-E-R-I. Tell folks how to get in touch with you, and then we'll sign off.
Very simply, you can email Tim or I. It's tim@evanstherapy.com or Jerry, G-E-R-I, @cartertherapy.com. And you can ask us any questions that you want. And we are so looking forward to seeing you, Peter, in hardly wait.
Thank you much. And folks, we'll see you in Tampa, Florida. Look it up on my website or get in touch with Tim and Jerry. Thank you.
Thank you.